This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
The Idaho 4 murder details. If the world had known what we know now, there would never have been a Brian Koberger plea deal. This would have gone to the death penalty. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
Some of these might be familiar, so sit up straight when I talk to you. How was your life right before you murdered my sisters? Did you prepare for the crime before leaving your apartment? Please detail what you were thinking and feeling at this time. Why did you choose my sisters? Before leaving their home, is there anything else you did? How does it feel to know the only thing you failed more miserably at than being a murderer is trying to be a rapper?
Details only now being revealed to the public? If the world had known the horrific injuries and more details, there would never have been a plea deal. The public would have rioted at the courthouse steps. We are learning that one of these beautiful co-eds stabbed 30 times, another even more. Keely Gonsalves's face so many times, she is disfigured and beyond identification. It goes on and on. Why was all of this kept secret? So everyone would accept the plea deal and think it was for the best? Thank you for being with us, with me, an all-star panel. But first, straight out to Joe Scott Morgan, professor of forensics, Jacksonville State University, star of a hit podcast, Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan, and author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon. Joe Scott, I can hardly take it in what we are learning. First of all, Joe Scott, listen to this.
Officers responding to the 911 call from 1122 King Road find the kitchen door ajar. During a walk through the rental house, officers notice blood is smeared on the walls and floors and pooling by the bodies on different floors of the house. Three of the four victims were stabbed multiple times, and officers were unable to sort out additional injuries. Injuries were so bad to one of the victims, an officer said the victim was unrecognizable.
Unrecognizable. And before you weigh in, Joe Scott, I want you to hear this as well.
Keely Gonsalves had already moved out of the King Road home, but returned to show her best friend Maddie her new Range Rover. An officer on scene described her face as disfigured. Keely's fatal injuries included a left lung laceration, a liver laceration, two subdural bleeds, and a stab behind her clavicle, which cut her subclavian vein and artery. She had signs of sharp force injuries and blunt force injuries, and was the only victim to suffer asphyxia injuries.
Keely Gonsalves was stabbed 34 times. Her facial structure was extremely damaged, leaving her unrecognizable due to the severity of the stab wounds, and she was identified by methods other than simple visual recognition. Besides defensive marks on her arms, Keely had a broken nose, two brain bleeds, and a stab behind her clavicle, which severed the subclavian vein and artery.
Joe Scott, that's just one of the victims. Can you imagine what she lived through? No wonder her father, Steve Gonsalves, is beside himself. These facts kept secret from the public until after the deal goes down. I don't like it.
No, I don't. And this far, you know, the level of trauma here, Nancy, far exceeded my expectation. Okay, from what I've been hearing, lo, these many years that we've been covering these cases, I did not expect it to be to this degree. The brutality here that has been exacted on these kids is unimaginable. The trauma, the proximity to these individuals per the perpetrator. I mean, this is an asymmetrical attack where he is literally, would literally have to be on top of a couple of these victims, just kind of hammering down on them, not just with the blade itself, but also inducing this blunt force trauma, which many of these victims have sustained, Nancy. There's also other evidence other than just sharp force injury. We've got indication that markings left behind may have been generated as a result of potentially punching.
Okay, well, let me make sense of what you are just saying, okay, because you use a lot of technical terms. Kayla Gonzalez was asphyxiated. Okay, there were marks on her mouth. There were other signs that she had been suffocated or strangled. But what is so shocking to me amongst all of this, it's all shocking, is that there are multiple stabs to the face. Susan Hendricks is joining me. She has been camped outside the county courthouse there from the get-go. Author of Down the Hill, My Descent to the Double Murder in Delphi. There she did another deep, deep look at the Delphi murders. Susan Hendricks, am I understanding this correctly? All the injuries sustained by Kelly, and that's not even the worst. I think Maddie Mogan had even more stab wounds. But all of these stab wounds to the face, Susan Hendricks?
Yes, to me that shows a deep-rooted hate and envy for those women. You're absolutely right, Nancy, when you say, no wonder Steve was so furious. And he didn't even know what we know now. And I remember early on, Nancy, you'll remember too, that the coroner said they were likely sleeping. What? That almost sounds deliberate to turn the people off, to say, oh, nothing to see here, knocking down the house. I mean, these injuries, horrific. You're right. Maddie Mogan, wounds to the face. Zanna Kernodle, more than 50 stab wounds. 50. It's unbelievable.
50 to Zanna. Zanna. 50 stab wounds. And what's so crazy about this is, let me go to a shrink. Dr. John Della Torre is joining us, and I want to follow up on what Susan Hendricks just said. Della Torre, psychologist specializing in forensic psychology. All these wounds to the face. Now, I'm just a trial lawyer, okay? But this means something psychologically. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't care if the angel Gabriel came down and told me it means nothing, I'd have to call him a liar. Because when you stab a woman in the face 50 times, or in this case, Kayla Gonzalez, 20, 30 times, Dr. John Della Torre, what does it mean?
I think, you know, other guests are going to talk about the level of hate and animosity towards it. But for me, he literally tried to erase her. He literally tried to erase her identity from this planet. He hated her so much that she couldn't even exist as a human being anymore. That's the level of brutality that we're dealing with here. When he walked into that room, he imagined that she would no longer exist as a human. That's what he was searching for. That's what he was doing with all of this stuff. And whatever way that he could accomplish that, he was going to spend the time necessary, because imagine how much time that he has to spend choking and then stabbing all across her body, and then the amount of times on her face. That takes time. That's not something that's just easily done. So he wanted to do this specifically to her, to erase her identity from this planet.
What is so bizarre, Dr. Della Torre, is that he was not insane. Not insane now. Not insane then, not temporary insanity at the time. And when you look at him as he's sitting there and sentencing, and he's looking, as some described it, and Susan Hendricks was there, when he was looking at the victims' families, you know, crying and snotting and begging for the truth, he was described as like looking like a hawk watching its prey, enjoying watching it squirm. And this is the guy that stabbed this young girl up to 50 times in the face, the body. But I've read a lot of studies, and I put a lot of experts on the stand, Dr. Della Torre, that explain that when an attacker specifically attacks a woman's face or her genitals, it's an anti-woman thing. He is destroying her beauty. And there have been a lot of analyses done on Koberger implicating him as an incel, an involuntary celibate that hates women because he can't get women. Explain what this all means, the attack to the victim's face. Not just one. Kelly was totally disfigured. Dylan couldn't even identify her. You heard that she had to be identified by means other than a visual identification. Like you see in the movies and TV, P.S. that doesn't happen anymore, where the loved one is brought in and they pull the sheet back. That doesn't happen anymore. But when they asked Dylan who was that, she couldn't identify Kelly, right? That's how bad it was. She was stabbed so many times in the face.
This is clearly gender-based hatred. Clearly gender-based hatred. When we talk about the incels, what we need to remember is that they're primarily an online forum in which all of these, you know, sad sack losers blame women for all of their problems. Now, when we look at Koberger, we can certainly see that there are elements in which he viewed women as being subservient, as not being qualified to be in the same room as him. But there's a level of hatred here when it comes to these behaviors that he's been fostering for a long period of time. He's had to learn to control all of these behaviors. And that's why I think you saw him the way that, we all saw him when it came to the victim statements. He's taking it all in. He's listening to it. He's in control, so he believes. And he's not going to let anybody see what's underneath the hate.
I got another wrench to throw in the works for you to just mull over. We learn from Inmates Behind Bars now that he obsessively washes his hands over and over and over and will spend over an hour in the shower behind bars. So the dichotomy of him obsessively cleaning himself, but yet stabbing these victims up to 50 times each. Then we see him, Susan Hendricks, as you did in the sentencing, and he did. He looked like a hawk staring at a little varmint caught in its talons, just watching it squirm. He liked it, Susan.
Yeah, he absolutely loved it. And I think he, for lack of a better term, got off on the women going up to the podium. Besides Olivia Gonzalez, he did not like her. I could tell by his clenched jaw, but with the women, the surviving roommates crying. And he also didn't like the men. The men and Kelly's father turning the podium. And on the podium, it said, "Do not move." He didn't listen, focused right at Koberger and said, "You picked the wrong family." And by the way, they had heard about the 30 plus stab wounds with Kelly right
before.
Hey,
Susan, you know what? No. Susan, spare me. Okay.
I'm hoping because that, he got that it affected off.
Him. He's living. He's breathing. And I you and the victim's families are paying for it. And what I want to know, if you have any idea, why all this was kept secret until after the deal was done and it couldn't be undone. There would have been a mob on the courthouse steps if they had known Kelly, for one, like the others, was so attacked, brutally stabbed. And think about it, Joe Scott, maybe I'm not explaining this well. The K-bar knife, and you got the same exact K-bar knife, as did I. To think of that knife in this girl's face, what, 30 times that we know of, and many of those wounds were overlapping, so you can't differentiate one versus two versus three if the stab comes down in the same spot in her face. This guy is laughing at everybody. He's probably writing a book right now.
Yeah, he is, and I'm sure that there are academics out there that are salivating at the opportunity to get to sit in a cell with him, and he's going to have control now, Nancy. He's going to have control of the conversation because he was not forced to allocute. I'll keep preaching that over and over again. An academic will go in there and he will get ready for him to be able to tell his side of the story. Let me tell you one more if you like that one. This is what I believe. I believe that there is probably an institution out there somewhere around the world that will allow him in prison to complete his PhD. Just chew on that for a second. After what he did to these kids, over and over and over again, he brutalized each and every one of them to the point where you've got one child that's completely unrecognizable, and you've got another one that sustained so many stab wounds that you cannot begin to fully appreciate the savagery, I don't think, that she went through in those last moments of her life. And one more thing about Ethan. You know that image that we've seen for years and years now of that streaking down the side of the house. Well, Nancy, that turns out that that was positively examined, and it turns out that that was Ethan's blood. As a forensic scientist, I'm not going to look at an image, and you can take this to the bank. I've never said that that was blood. But after they have released this information, they've said that's his blood. That gives you an idea relative to the volume of terror, the volume of trauma that these kids were subjected to. And it's actually visualized on the outside of that house.
Not only that, Joe Scott, the evidence that Kayla Gonsalves was asphyxiated. It's not just all the stab wounds to the face.
Yep.
He silenced her. Listen.
Damage around her mouth, suggesting Koberger tried to silence or gag her in some way. The family lawyer suggested a second weapon was used to inflict blunt force trauma to her face, while others believe the trauma could have been caused by the butt of the K-bar knife. Haley's asphyxia injuries were caused by blunt force trauma to her face and mouth area, potentially alongside other forms of restriction or obstruction.
Joe Scott, please explain that, that this was caused by the butt of his knife. Is that like pistol whipping somebody with the butt of a gun, but you're doing it with the butt of that K-bar? What does this mean?
No, what it means is when this knife was developed, Nancy, for the Marine Corps to use in the field. They use it for a variety of things. Did you know that in combat, you can use this as a bludgeon? Look at that. What does it look like? It looks like the leading edge of a hammer, doesn't it? And this thing is steel. So as you're driving it down like a piston, you're actually driving it down into the tissue. That's going to explain a lot of the fractures that you might see with her face potentially, because he's in such close proximity to her as he's traumatizing her.
Please describe in detail the level of anxiety you must have felt when you heard the Bearcat pull up to your family home on December 30th, 2022. Which do you regret more? Returning to the crime scene 5 hours later, or never, ever going back to Moscow, not even once, after stalking them there for months? If you were really smart, do you think you'd be here right now? What's it like needing this much attention just to feel real? You're terrified of being ordinary, aren't you? Do you feel anything at all? Or are you exactly what you always feared? Nothing. If you're so powerful, then why are you still hiding, defendant? You see, I'm here today as me. But who are you? Let's try to take off your mask and see. The truth is, the scariest part about you is how painfully average you turned out to be. You're as dumb as they come. Stupid, clumsy, slow, sloppy, weak, dirty. Don't ever try to convince yourself you mattered just because someone finally said your name out loud.
You're seeing Koberger there in the sentencing. Susan Hendricks described the way he looked, which is a complete opposite of the person that carried out these knowing but frenzied acts on the victim. 50 stab wounds, 30 stab wounds, disfiguring Kelly's face with a K-bar knife and the butt of the knife. What was he like in that sentencing?
Nancy, there was no movement at all. Stoic, staring straight ahead. The only time I saw any facial expression is when he walked in the beginning and then after the break and smiled towards his mother. Other than that, my dad was watching at home and said, he has to be on medication. What? He's making zero movement. I said, no, he doesn't have the feelings. They're just not there.
Guys, compare his demeanor in the courtroom to the frenzied attack on the victims. Listen.
The severity of Kaylee's injuries was such that even roommate Dylan Mortensen initially misidentified Kaylee as Zanuck due to the disfigurement. Zanuck Kernodle was awake, and her order from Jack in the Box had just been delivered when she appears to have heard something going on in the room upstairs occupied by Maddie and Kaylee. As Zanna is on the stairs leading upstairs, she was confronted by Koberger exiting Maddie's room, and he attacks Zanna as she attempts to retreat to her room.
Joining me is Chris McDonough, Director of Cold Case Foundation, former homicide detective who has scoured the scene as well. I want you to hear this and then give me your analysis of how Zanna was attacked by Koberger. It's nothing like we were told at the beginning, like Susan Hendricks was saying, oh, they all were killed in their sleep. Okay, like they drifted off to death. It's anything but. Listen to this, Chris.
Koberger attacks Zanna, but she puts up a fight and sustains more than 50 stab wounds. Many of Zanna's wounds are defensive wounds. And a gash on her left hand between her index finger and thumb, as well as blunt force injuries on her body. A life and death struggle between Zanna and Koberger took place in her room. Zanna's fatal injuries were identified as a laceration to her right lung and two lacerations to her heart.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
So he was stabbing her so brutally, he lacerated her lung and twice to the heart. Was he just sitting on top of her, just stabbing her over and over and over? What about this? You've had a lot of theories about the way this thing went down. And if the public, if the world had known what we're learning now, I think the courthouse would have been surrounded by torches and pitchforks, for Pete's sake, not to let that sweetheart deal go through. It sounds like Zanna hears something. She was awake because she had just gotten that order from Jack in the Box. She hears something going on upstairs in the room occupied by Maddie and Kelly. She's on the stairs that lead to upstairs, and then it's then she's confronted by Koberger. Give me your scenario.
So, Nancy, I mean, we've talked about this many times on your show. Just think about this idea of the frenzy that's taking place on the third floor that Doc Morgans are talking about, where this guy is trying to erase everybody that he's contacting with. And now you have this young, innocent, you know, human being who hears what's going on upstairs, interrupts it, and then he turns on her like the wolf that he is, and then slaughters her. I think that was probably the time he dropped the sheath, because he's in this frenzy.
Joe Scott, describe the injuries to Zanna.
Zanna, the interesting thing about her injuries, Nancy, is that she's got multiple defensive injuries. That's why I use the term that she fought. This was like a titan-like fight. She knows that her life is coming to an end, or she's trying to avoid it. And so she's got multiple injuries where she's raising her arm like this and her hand, and these cuts run onto her arm where if you're talking about sword play or knife play, you're talking about a term called a parry, where you're trying to defend yourself like this. Do you remember, Nancy, the first bit of physical trauma information that was actually leaked out in this case had to do specifically with Zanna? And it had to do with the fact that knife had been drawn through her hand to the point where her tendons were cut. And I knew at that moment in time, that was several months ago, it seems like now, I knew at that time that she had fought ferociously. I just didn't realize, Nancy, that this was going to wind up with a total of 50 injuries to this diminutive young woman. And I see this, and then I see that reptile in court, and I think about this is no match here physically, showing up with a combat knife, and he is literally just full of anger and rage. I'm not saying that Zanna was the target. I'm saying, like Chris had said, that she became kind of like an impediment to him getting ready to exfil out of that house. She got in his way, and you know, Katie barred the door at that point in time. The totality of his rage is taken out on her at this point in the aftermath.
And joining me now is a veteran trial lawyer, Greg Morse, criminal defense attorney at Morse Legal, author of The Untested on Amazon. Greg, there's no need to argue with me about guilt or innocence because he's already pled guilty. All right. He's behind bars right now. And you're going to hear this, Greg. He's got a tablet. He's got an iPad. He can watch movies. He can communicate with the outside world. He's got email. He can listen to music. He can have his vegan diet. He can write books. There is no Son of Sam law in Idaho, which means He can make money off of his books and his appearances if he dials into some, no Son of Sam protection laws in Idaho. He can zoom in from his laptop to the next criminal defense gala and give his side. He didn't speak, of course, at sentencing. He won't be cross-examined. Blah, blah, blah. It goes on. He can have visits from women. He can have girlfriends. Look at Jorn Vandersloot. He's had two children behind bars. It goes on. Greg Morse, I want to talk to you about why these incendiary, think about that word, incendiary. What is an incendiary device? Like a Molotov cocktail. You throw it, it hits, and it blows up and destroys everything around it. These incendiary facts are now being released after the deed is done, Greg. And I think that is wrong.
Well, it's not. It's that the case is over. And I'd be shocked if all the family members didn't have access to this information if they wanted to with the prosecutor. You know, you were a prosecutor, Nancy. Criminal law is not for the media. It happens in the courtroom and in offices, and it's very different than what gets played out in public. And at the end of the day, while you can look at these facts and say they're right, they're aggravating factors. If this were the death penalty and we moved on to the death penalty phase of the case, he went to trial and was convicted, the government would be obviously putting all of these extreme violence that he did to these people as aggravating factors that warrant the death penalty. However, all of that being said, that doesn't bring solace. It doesn't change the fact that he has multiple life sentences. The family will not feel
I'm
their
not
comfort
asking
won't happen
you
if he's
about
killed.
Solace. I'm certainly not asking a criminal defense attorney to speak to the suffering of crime victims. You represent the bad guys. Okay, let's just get that straight. Okay, that's what you do. I'm asking you about the fact that these incendiary details were kept secret. And yes, I understand that they were kept secret for a reason. But in my mind, this is justification to seek the death penalty, not to have him laid up in a cell, washing his hands with Purell, watching an X-rated video on his iPad. No.
Well, again,
and now we're learning Kelly was disfigured with a K-bar knife to the face, 30 times?
I didn't need to read all of that information. You're right. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't stop crime. There are people in the Idaho maximum prison since 1985 that are still waiting for execution. Nobody doesn't commit a crime because someone got the death penalty. Those type of cases do not lead to that result. The death penalty is a waste. All it would do in this case is not bring closure
to the family. Okay, I didn't ask you again to start preaching the pros and cons of the death penalty.
I'm not preaching.
I'm telling you and asking you, do you think the public would have gone along with this deal if they had known the truth?
The public's irrelevant.
Me,
it's about
I
the
care.
Victims. That's all that matters. But no one cares. You're not in the case. Nobody cares. Like, it doesn't matter. You don't matter. No one matters. I don't matter. It's those victims' families that matter. And prosecutors, you were one. You have to make a hard choice in difficult situations. And there is absolutely no doubt.
You know what, Greg Morse? It does matter. It does matter because prosecutors are entrusted to do the right thing. This was not the right thing. To stab a young girl in the face 30 or more times with that thing right there, and nobody knows that until now. No. You keep saying you don't matter. I don't matter. That's BS. We do matter. Every voice matters. Every voice matters. He was entrusted with doing the right thing by the public. Doing the right thing for the public. The people in Idaho. And this was not the right thing. Now we're learning about all of these disgusting facts. I mean, Joe Scott, you've scoured the medical examiner's report. What repels you the most, if you can even pick?
I don't know that I can. I can't narrow it down because it's so vast. Nancy, out of all the cases certainly that I've covered in the media, this far surpasses when you're talking about an edged weapon. I've never seen this. Nancy, I never saw it in all my years in practice in New Orleans and Atlanta. I've never seen four people this disfigured, this brutalized in one location with one case. This far exceeds anything that I can imagine. But also there's one other element here, and this might be more of a John comment, but the idea that the terror that they lived in those final moments, and I don't know that we can take the measure, I think, on trauma. You can't take the measure on what they went through in those final moments, Nancy. It's something that you cannot absolutely quantify.
Madison Mogan might have been asleep when Brian Koberger snuck into the room to attack, but she woke up to fight back against her killer. Maddie had defensive wounds to her forearms and hands, indicating she was not stabbed to death in her sleep with no awareness to what was happening. Her death was caused by lacerations to her liver and left lung from sharp force injuries, and she suffered a gash extending from her eye to her nose. On the third floor, Kaylee and Madison are found together in a bed under a pink blanket covered in blood. There is a large pool of blood near Kaylee's midsection and blood spatter on the walls. The officer notes Maddie appears to be laying up against Kaylee, and Maddie has what appear to be wounds to her forearm and hands. A gash from under her right eye appears to go from the corner of her eye to her nose. The officer notes Kaylee is unrecognizable as her facial structure is extremely damaged.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
You want the truth? Here's the one you'll hate the most. If you hadn't attacked them in their sleep, in the middle of the night, like a pedophile, Kaylee would have kicked your ass. Thank you.
As Zanna Kernodle puts up a fight, her boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, appears to have been asleep and never woke up. Ethan died from sharp force injuries, and the fatal injury was a stab wound under his left clavicle. This wound severed his subclavian vein and subclavian artery, as well as his jugular vein.
Talk like that would have thrown me completely over the edge of a cliff if I were trying this case. You have to have the medical examiner explain in regular people talk what he's saying. What he's saying is that Ethan was likely attacked in his sleep, his body found lying in bed, partially under a blanket covering his midsection. And bottom line, Susan Hendricks, his jugular vein was sliced. There was arterial bleeding, which likely went all the way up to the ceiling. That's what happened to this beautiful young boy. Explain, Susan Hendricks.
Absolutely. And the authorities who first came into that room says there was blood smeared all over the walls. And I go back to the coroner saying they were likely killed in their sleep. It looked like a horror scene, like a movie, all around that house. And the attorney mentioned, defense attorney, who matters? Guess who felt like they didn't matter? All of the family members. And Kaylee's father has been saying that from the start. And he didn't even know the extent of the injuries, so much so they mattered that they only had 24 hours. They found out via email that there was a plea deal that was reached. They felt like they didn't matter. They were a secondary thought.
Okay, Greg Morse, you can put that, let me just put it mildly.
Well,
I can think of a lot of places you could shove that. Put it in your pipe and smoke it.
Let's correct the mischaracterization.
This deal was already done and sealed before the family got to even talk about it.
The victim and the families matter, not the panelists. And also, correct the information. Son of Sam laws.
She's talking about the victim's family.
Unconstitutional. So just to say who matters, what I'm talking about is the public's view for justice, mercy, whatever, doesn't matter. It's about the victims, the victim's family, the prosecutor. So we're talking about this in a vacuum, but the prosecutor's spoken with the victim's family, and the only thing that can give them solace is their loved one back, and that's impossible. So of course they're going to be upset, some aren't.
Correct him, if you don't mind, Susan Hendricks. Wasn't this plea agreed upon before the victims' families found out about it? I'm not talking about the public. I'm not talking about Morse or anybody else on this panel. Because at least to that little tiny bit extent, Morse is right. What we think doesn't matter because it's already done. It's over. Isn't it true, Hendricks, that this deal was agreed upon before the family even knew about it? They were notified in an email, hey, here's the deal.
Yeah. Steve Gonzalez was so furious, he didn't even go into court when it was announced that a plea deal has been reached. He was infuriated. Kaylee's brother is still, they're all still infuriated. Didn't speak at the victim impact statements. He said, I just feel like I couldn't contain myself. What was decided around us, not for us, around us, giving them really 24 hours to get to that courtroom to hear that a plea deal has been reached. They felt left out. They didn't even know. And I don't know what kind of inspired the prosecutor, if you will, to tell them how brutal the attacks were, but they heard just hours before the victim impact statements. They weren't even going to hear then. It's just, they kept them out. You're right. We don't matter. They do. And they were tossed to the side in this, I believe.
And let me be very, very clear regarding Son of Sam laws. A U.S. Supreme Court case, I believe it was about the movie Wise Guys, but regardless of the movie, the Supreme Court reversed the Son of Sam law, the national law. However, since that time, 40 or more states have enacted their own statewide Son of Sam laws that comply to the federal U.S. Supreme Court case. So there are Son of Sam laws in effect right now that are constitutionally approved, but not Idaho. Therefore, Koberger can make money. Yes, he can. Oh, yes, he can. Now, we are also learning from recently released files that Koberger is caught red-handed stalking the victims. We find out in the files that repeatedly these young girls saw someone lurking in that tree line. Hey, New York Control Room, please show me the home, the King Road address, especially that one video where McDonough and I walked up behind the house. There's a higher vantage point. If you can get the video, get it, because that's the tree line I think they're talking about, Chris McDonough. Repeatedly, the dog, I think the dog's name is Murphy, would go and attack the tree line uncharacteristically. I mean, you know when your dog is doing something they don't normally do. There you go. There you go. There's a tree line. I think they're talking about Chris McDonough. They saw a shadowy figure skulking in those trees. The dog would go and attack at the time they saw the shadowy figure and when they didn't see the shadowy figure, but they now believe he was there. And hold on, McDonough, you've got to see this before you weigh in. On one of his many outings to scout the murder scene, idiot Koberger was actually pulled over. Watch this killer on cam.
Hey there. I stopped you going a little fast. You realize this is 35?
Oh, it's 35?
It is, yeah.
I'm so you're going about 41?
Yeah, 43 is what the radar said.
For sure.
Oh, yeah. Do you have your license, the registration insurance? Were you wearing your seatbelt when I stopped you?
No.
No? That's no good.
Right. Just being honest with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I mean, really? Chris McDonough, he's on his way to stalk the victims, to spy on them, sneak around, skulk in that tree line, and watch them maybe inside undressing or whatever he tried to catch visually. And he's pulled over for exceeding speed limit, not wearing a seatbelt. How relieved is he? He's planning a quadruple murder, Chris.
Yeah, Nancy, and you and I stood right there and looked in the same vantage point he did. And so, you know, it's important to understand if you're going to go sit down with Satan, you better understand the neighborhood he hangs out in. And when you have the district attorney later on here, not taking a shot at my colleague here, but when you have the DA, you know, coming and telling the world, we're not really sure what his motive is. We're not sure if there's a sexual component to this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what are you sure of then in its totality? Because the public is sure, okay, they're connecting the dots that, you know, there's information that this guy brutally did what he did, how he did it. And all of a sudden, the families becoming an attachment to the email that, oh, by the way, we're going to make a deal with the devil here. There's something wrong here. There's something definitely wrong here.
You know, I want you to hear this, too. So here he is. He's out stalking the victims. And we have him on video en route to the murder scene. He's pulled over for exceeding the speed limit, not by much. And he's worried about insurance. Listen.
Yeah, I just have a question about that. So in terms of, like, you know, when you get a speed limit, that's obviously reported to your insurance. Is the same thing for the seatbelt?
I don't think so. I think it's only moving violations that go to insurance or things that might put points on your license.
Yeah.
But I'm not 100% sure. Okay. Could I get a phone number from you?
Yeah, why?
We need to put it on the citation as it goes to the court.
And he's worried that his phone number is going to be on the citation. He ain't crazy, Delatory. He's asking about his driver's license, registration, insurance. He doesn't want his cell number on the police report. He is not crazy. No wonder they didn't put up the insanity defense. Because you play this, here he is out stalking the victim's home, and he's caught, and he's perfectly sane.
Yeah, he's perfectly sane. He's clearly logical and rational in what he's wanting to do. Now, the behavior that he ends up doing is completely irrational. There's no reason for him to have done this other than he wanted to. That's the key. Everything was about him wanting to hurt these people. Everything is about how he feels frustrated and just wants to erase these people as an exemplar of his overall level of frustration with what's going on.
I think he wanted more than that, Delatory. I think he wanted to have sex with the women, but he has been rejected by people so many times. I mean, whoa. Isn't it true? Dave Mack joining me, Crime Stories investigative reporter, that one woman met up with him via Tinder. And he started asking her about what would be the worst way to be murdered. That was their last date. What happened, Dave Mack?
They actually met through Tinder, like you said. And during the course of their date, the date shares a story of a murder that took place in her hometown. And as they talked further, Koberger actually asked her about what would the worst way to die be. And I think she said knife. And he suggested, out of the thin air, a K-bar knife. Until this story came out, Nancy, a lot of us had no idea of what a K-bar knife was. Why would anyone bring it up on a date?
Let's let the defense attorney answer that. So he meets a Tinder date. He wants to have sex with her.
Yep.
So his lead up to that, to woo her, is talking about what would be the worst way for her to be murdered? And she says, by knife. He goes, oh, like a K-bar? What a coinkydink, Greg Morse.
No, you're right. And I think, you know, this is the unfortunate situation of society. People don't think someone acting weird or something. They just kind of forget about it. It's out of their life. But that's why I keep non-emergency police agency number in my
it's
phone for my local
fault.
Community. No, that's not what I'm saying. You're sitting here talking What I'm saying. So let's talk about when
society's fault.
What I'm pointing out, you're 100% right. That's a bizarre way to talk to a woman you're on a date with, right? That's unusual. He's a weird guy. We also have the experience they reported
to him
of
that
him
is
at the
probative,
strip club.
Man.
It's well,
he got
okay,
a couple of weeks before
probative.
The murder, and
but
he's talking
Nancy,
to his
right.
sex target
Do
about a K-bar.
Nancy, any prosecutor could win this case. Like, this is easy to win from the prosecution side. So what does that add to where we are today? Nothing. He would have been convicted. He committed the crimes. And my guess is, if you look through this guy's video history, he probably watched the documentary, The Cheshire Murders, at some point, because this is very reminiscent, except not as extreme, because they lit their victims on fire in Connecticut. And the Connecticut chose to bring the death penalty back for those two, where Idaho chose not to follow it in this case and give life sentences. But my guess is, when he went to that strip club and he was the only person there, he was tempted to maybe act out then, but he got scared. That's why he didn't. He was leading up to what unfortunately happened to those young folks that he was convicted of. But there's all these instances
like some kind of an accident. Dilatory.
No, not an intentional.
Do you hear more?
It's intentional.
Oh, I'm still hearing him. It's like a gnat. I can hear it, but I can't see it. Dr. Dilatory, you hear Morse saying something about society, blah, 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 and then it's an unfortunate thing that happened. It's like they had an accident or something. This is not unfortunate. It's a quadruple, premeditated, frenzied, brutal attack. You can't explain it away. And the deal was done in secret and presented by email to the victim's family. If the world had known the facts we're learning now, and I'm just, this is a tip of the iceberg. No one would have agreed to this. There would be an uprising, an insurrection.
Yeah, I think the idea is what we have to remember, that there are no coincidences in murder investigations. Right. These past behaviors are clearly indicative of what he has going on in his mind, because it's too specific. As for the deal happening in secret, I mean, in what other way can the prosecutor kind of get this through if it's not in secret? I think the prosecutor knew that this was going to look poorly amongst the community, amongst society, and amongst the victim's family. So he needed to push it through in a way that he can kind of say, you know, listen, this was kind of spur of the moment. We needed to get this done. I think in the prosecutor's mind, he's probably trying to save the feelings of the family, but the family deserved their opportunity to have their voices heard in court.
Surviving roommate Dylan Mortensen heard a person she believed was Kaylee scream that somebody was in the house, then heard someone run down from the third floor to Zanna's room on the second floor, where she then heard what she called a commotion. Mortensen hears an unfamiliar male voice say, "You're going to be fine. I'm going to help you."
Dylan was in her room while hearing the commotion, only briefly opening up her door to see if she could tell what was happening. After hearing the man saying, "I'm going to help you," Dylan opens the door and sees Koberger, describing him to Officer Nunes as 6 feet tall, slim build, a black mask with bushy eyebrows.
Joe Scott Morgan joining us, professor of forensics and star of Body Bags podcast with Joe Scott Morgan. Joe Scott, the prosecutor has come out and said the reason Koberger didn't murder Dylan Mortensen is because he, Koberger, was afraid. Didn't he say that, Susan Hendricks?
Absolutely afraid that maybe someone would see him because of all the commotion. But now that I hear the details, they are so lucky. I believe he would have done it in an instant, killed Bethany and Dylan if he saw them.
Joe Scott, that's total BS. He just frenzy attacked a young girl, stabbing her in the face, what, 30 times, another one 50 times in total, slicing Ethan's jugular vein, asphyxiation, beating with the butt of a knife, blah. It just, he's not afraid of Dylan Mortensen. Why is the prosecutor saying that?
I don't know. I've given this some thought, Nancy. And one of the things that I'd kind of thought about, if he is targeting one of the two victims on the third floor, he goes in, he murders, slaughters both these two precious souls. Then as he's on an adrenaline high at that moment in time. And so after that adrenaline dump, he's coming down the staircase, at which time he encounters Zanna. And it's then his adrenaline, he gets another adrenaline dump, chases her into the room. I think that he's completely exhausted. I think that probably he's got the 1,000-yard stare where he's just focused on trying to get the hell out of this place as quickly as he can. And, you know, I don't know. I guess he has a survival instinct. He seems like he's more bent on trying to impress law enforcement at traffic stops. And then, of course, we hear about him trying to dominate the initial conversation that he had with the police. He's kind of hard to figure out, but I don't think that he is truly hard to figure out. Again, I think he's like a reptile. I don't think he has a soul, Nancy. I really don't.
We stop now to remember an American hero, Officer Jacob Chaffins, Prestonburg PD, just 28 years old, shot in the line of duty, leaves behind grieving widow, wife Hannah, and little girl Paisley. American hero, Officer Jacob Chaffins. Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend. This is an iHeart podcast, guaranteed human.